remember it. When he first came into town, him and Pastor Lanny formed a friendship, and I've kind of watched him from afar off, so to speak, mostly just getting to know people that go to South Point, and it's been a real joy. I feel connected to him in a very real way just because I get to see his people, if you want to call it that. It's probably not the right way to put it, but just really gotten to enjoy the South Park. Did I say South Park? I did it again. I get in so much trouble with this, Matt. I really don't watch the show, but I knew I was going to do that. South Point. I need to write it on a chalkboard 100 times. South Point, South Point, South Point. Anyway, it has just been a joy to get to know Rebecca and Mike and a whole handful of people that go to your church. And it's just been a joy. So I would like you all to please stand up and give a warm welcome to Matt Hall.
Okay, hopefully everyone's sitting down by the time I turn back around, so I'm not all embarrassed. Is it okay if I partially sit and partially stand? Would that be okay? And I don't know if I want something in front of me as I talk to people. I don't like that. Two things. As one who has struggled with recovery all of their life, I feel most at home in meetings like this. And here's why I feel most at home in meetings. Because when you're in a meeting with other people that know they're broken, you don't have to pretend. There's something freeing about the truth. When you can just come and be around other people and go, hey, before the cross, we are all in equal need of grace and mercy. And so I want you to know this morning, you know, I know you guys have awesome speakers and other pastors and stuff like that, but I count it I want you to hear my heart as I count it a great privilege and sacred trust to be here and to take 20 minutes, okay, let's not lie, 40 minutes of your 40 minutes of your life. So I say something pretty regularly at South Point, and I want to say it tonight. I often say we really don't care why you're here, so we don't care why you're here tonight. We really don't care where you've been. I don't care where you've been. Don't care what's been done to you or by you. I hope that you hear and see that you matter deeply to God. I really believe this is my personal, and I tell church people this. I say, church is just one giant recovery program. I know that when we struggle with addictions or habits or hurts or hang-ups, right? Like when we continually deal with those, we think that somehow, that is a unique thing. But what I've discovered, and I've been working with people for 20 plus years. I did a decade in Young Life. I know I don't look old enough, but it's the miles on the odometer, not the paint job, right? But I did a decade working with high school and middle school students, and I've already done a decade with church people. And here's what I know. Everyone is addicted to sin and selfishness. And apart from the power and grace found in a person named Jesus, that we will all live broken lives. So with that being said, I'm going to kind of dive in. How many of you here are Star Wars fans? Fans? All right, this is going to be easy. This is awesome. You guys are already terrific. I love it. Does anyone know that the new Star Wars movie called The Force Awakens is coming out in December, right? All right. Yes, like, woo, it's awesome. I love Star Wars. Matter of fact, I'm going to share a little bit of my story, and then through my story, I'm going to share those moments where God stepped in. And I am uniquely in love with the Star Wars because it was the one. That's all right. That's good. Better late than never, right? And so, the only good memory I have with my biological dad is when we went to see Star Wars. I mean, I can remember it. I was probably, I think I was 9 or 10. The movie came out in 1979, if my memory serves me correct. At that time, the reason we get the word blockbuster, some of you young folks don't understand this, but blockbusters meant you literally stood outside of the movie theater for a block. And I can remember with my dad that we were standing outside to see this movie, and we were together, and he was telling me how awesome it was going to be, and I was really excited. And I, you know what I remember about that moment is that when you went into the theater and the screen came on, there was a story. A story of good and a story of evil and a story of people in the good and the evil. A story with people who wanted friendships and who had family. Those that felt like they didn't matter. And those who felt like they mattered more than others. It's probably the only, like when I sit and think about my biological dad, it is the only memory that I think fondly on. And that is, that has severely impacted who I am and how I lived most of my life. And to be honest with you, it still impacts me today. I try to tell people, sometimes you just walk with a limp until you get to eternity. Some people will fool you and tell you that you will hit a stride where you never struggle. And I'd be like, well, I've been following Jesus for a really long time. You let me know when that happens. It started, my relationship with my dad was really non-existent. You see, my mom and my dad, they were really young. They were 17 and 18 when they had me. So they got married because they were pregnant with me. So you can tell I wasn't planned. They lasted about a year, and then they got divorced. And then my mom was a single mom. And you have to understand, this is in the 70s. Early 70s. I was born in 1969. This is the early 70s. It was not hip or cool, or it was not the norm for a woman to be single. And we were poor. And when I mean poor, we were really poor. I mean, we lived in housing where it was so run down that it had lead paint that kids weren't supposed to eat, and I ate the lead paint, and maybe that explains some things. You know, I can remember just being poor. I can remember my mom working multiple jobs and going to school, not really seeing my biological mom. She got remarried. My mom had her own problems. She got remarried to a guy who was a physical abuser, who was mean and cruel. And basically treated me like that, like I was something to be beat on and whipped. They eventually got divorced. My mom got pregnant again, and he made her give up the baby for adoption. So my mom and I went, we lived, again, we were poor. So we lived in government housing. But this time you have to understand, we were white, but we were so poor. We lived in a very urban area. I was the only white kid in my neighborhood. And I don't know if you can see my ears from where you're at. I don't know how you can, but like I had a bowl haircut and we were poor. And so like it was just, I stuck out like a sore thumb. And so I usually got beat up pretty regularly for the color of my skin. And it was pretty bad. And my mom got sick. That's at least what they lied. This is apparently what the adults of the 70s thought it was good to do to kids, was to lie to them. So they told me my mom was sick. And so I went to go stay with my biological dad, who had remarried my stepmom. And then a little bit later, she was dead. And they told me she died with an accident with a car, which was a lie. They lied to me. They didn't tell me the truth. My mom had actually taken her own life. And I was nine. You know, my biological dad and my stepmom, that was not a fun situation. They sent me to a Christian counselor who was a child molester. So I began to act. I mean, I know this is going to be shocking for many of y'all, but, you know, for a nine-year-old kid who loses his mom who gets sent to a child molester, I began to act out. A lot of pain. And so I'll never forget the day my dad picked me up from Boy Scouts. I eventually got kicked out of them too because of stealing and a bunch of other stupid stuff I did. I'll never forget this day. You know, my dad picked me up, and I could tell something was odd because my stepmom and the dog were in the car. I'm like, this is, you know, I mean, I'm not the brightest guy, but I knew something was up when my stepmom and the dog are in the, like, little station wagon, because usually they just pick me up and take me home, but I'm like, something's not right here. And my dad took me to the police station. And I'll never forget the look on his face as they interviewed me about, because I had broken into a house, and he looked at me, and he says, are you getting what you want? This is what you wanted, right? Like this look of utter disgust and disdain. You know, like, man, if I could have had a dog, I would have had a dog than you. And that started my journey into the juvenile justice system. I had already begun to drink. I had already started porn. Between the molestation, porn, and alcohol, you can only imagine. Before I was 10, I was already pretty warped as a human being. So when I got locked up, I learned how to do a lot of things even worse. I was really good at manipulating people. And I would do anything I could. I'd huff it, I'd sniff it, I'd stick it, I'd smoke it. As long as I didn't feel any pain on the inside. And so, I want to go back to the Star Wars thing. You see, I this finally hit me. And I wrote it down because I was thinking about our time together. You see, the truth is every human being feels legitimate pain and hurt in their life. Legitimate. Like it's real. Like whether it's from a parent, whether it's from a spouse, whether it's from a neighbor or a relative or something, whatever it is that happened to you, you're here because you realized there was something in your life that was painful, and it was legitimate. But just like in the movie Star Wars, you know what evil does? Evil takes the pain and the hurt, and it tries to tell you a false story. So let me say this again, because this is really important. See, here's what the evil does. It takes legitimate pain and hurt and it tells a false story. It'll tell you the story it told me. Well, you're no good. You're unlovable. You know what the only thing you're good for is to be abused, sexually and physically. You don't really matter. And if I don't matter, well, what's the point of living? And like my mom killed herself in what I call the instant plan. You know, just get it over and done with. But typically addicts, like me at least, we kill ourselves in the installment plan. One drink, one puff, one pill. Whatever it is, if it's a rush, if it's sex, if it's crime, we just kill ourselves in the installment plan. My life doesn't matter, who cares if I ruin it? I'm not loved and I'm not going to love anyone else. And that became the story of my life. I can remember. I got kicked out of this. I was in juvenile justice system for almost 4 years. I mean, I was in the juvenile justice system from 12 to almost 17. And I remember it was my second stint back in. It was Christmas. I wasn't 15. And they told me they were going to lock me up, throw the key away. And I contemplated taking my life. I go, my mom took her own life. My dad doesn't want me. What do I have worth living for? Eventually, I don't know how, I fooled enough people. I had a good enough head on my shoulders. Hey, if you want to get high and you want to be stupid, you do it after you get off of probation. Like, I'd seen enough people get out and then come back because they were on probation and then they messed up. And I was like, that seems stupid. Why don't you just wait till you're off probation, then you can do whatever you want and you're good. Like, that's just common sense to me. And so when I got out, they sent me to a foster home, which was, again, the story of my life was from one chaotic scene to another. I actually got sent to a religious, this person was affiliated with a religion and a church and was supposedly a person of authority, but they happened to be gay and they were living with their gay person and the foster system put me in with them. It lasted less than a year, mostly because I was an addict. I drank a lot. And in a night of drunken rage where I drank a fifth on one, and you look, I'm not a big guy. Cops showed up and I destroyed a bunch of stuff. And the foster people said, "Hey, no more of you." Took me out to dinner on Friday and told me Monday that they were getting out of the foster system and that I would have to find a place to stay. So that next Saturday morning, I called my probation officer and said, "Hey, my foster parents, they said they're not doing this anymore and I have a place to live." And here's the system. Isn't it beautiful? My probation officer said, "I tell you what, you're 6 months away from being 18. I won't make you take a pee test. You take care of yourself." Yep. Not really worth much. Same story. You don't matter. Legitimate hurt and pain, and the enemy twists it. But just like in the movie Star Wars, evil isn't all there is. There is goodness. There is the light. And there is truth. I was a youth pastor, a couple, they went to a church, and to be totally honest with you, it was a lot like this church right here. You know, welcoming and engaging, very charismatic, and the youth pastor couple were young people, and I came in and I had cigarettes and a mohawk and, you know, was all busted and broken and showed up at a church service. And you could tell I was different. And when I didn't have a place to stay, they said, "You can stay with us." And they shared the story of hope. You know, I know many of you come from different backgrounds. Some of you may be here just for the recovery. But the story of hope that they shared that I believe is true about life is that there's a God who made us. There's a God who loves us. And He wants to be our friend. He wants us to have life. Now, for someone like me, and probably for most of you in this room, there's been so much hurt in our lives that when someone tells us that, it's just another con, isn't it? It's just something someone says to us to get money or obedience or for us to follow them. It's just words to manipulate people. But in this young couple, they loved a crazy addict. And for the first time, I actually saw what love looked like. And I began to hope. I began to dream that there really might be a God who would love someone as busted as me. But if you're honest with yourself, can we be honest? I mean, hopefully recovery is one place we can be honest. That is the scariest thing to ever hear. Because if I'm no longer the victim, and I actually am loved, and I actually am valued, then who am I? Who am I without all my rage? Who am I without all my pain? I mean, what story do I have if it isn't the story of being the victim and the abused and the angry and the... Like, if that all goes away, then what do I got? Like, I don't have anything. I don't have a mom and a dad. I don't even have my addiction. I don't have anything. And so often what I find in recovery is that the scariest place is when you realize that you don't have to stay the addict or the victim, that you no longer have to believe the false story. Because believing the true story that you are meant to be a son or daughter of the Most High who spoke the universe into existence, that's scary. Can we be honest? It's much easier to hide in our addiction and our problems than it is to live in freedom and to step out. That's risky. But most of you know this. Killing yourself in the installment plan doesn't feel good for very long. It's tiring. You just get tired of telling the same lies over and over to different people. tired, just feeling dead on the inside. I was a little bit scared because my habits owned me. Slowly but surely, I began to believe the truth that there was a God who loved me. In Matthew 12, Jesus is speaking to the crowds, and these are the words of Jesus. He says, I thought I printed it. Let me see. Do I not have my printer? Well, I'll just read it to you in this version. It says, when an evil or impure spirit comes out of a person, it goes through arid places seeking rest, and it does not find it. Then it says, I will return to the house that I left. And when it arrives, it finds the house unoccupied, swept and clean, and put in order. Then it goes and takes seven other spirits more wicked than itself, and they go in and live there. And the final condition of that person is worse than the first. And you might be like, Matt, that's really odd. Why'd you read that? Because I think there comes a moment in our recovery process with Christ where we have to make a decision that whatever our no is, isn't no to or an addiction or to a thing. See, sobriety isn't about not doing something. Can you at least nod your head like you're I want everyone to understand, your sobriety and my sobriety is not about not doing something. For many of us, we think it's about not taking a drink, not having a pill, not looking at porn, not control. Like, we all think about the things that our sobriety is in the not doing that thing. But I think we miss the very point that Jesus is trying to communicate. You do that to fill the inside of something that is empty and dead. So the question isn't to stop doing, sobriety isn't about stopping that. It's about going, what will fill me? What do I need to say yes to? What do I need to say yes to versus saying no to a drink, no to a pill, no to a one-night stand? What do I need to say no to? What do I need to say yes to? Can I say yes to purity that when I look at men and women, I don't see them as objects to be used, but as brothers and sisters and other people? Can I be filled instead of getting high and numbing the pain? How can I step into the pain and say, hey, you know what? I may not let the dysfunction of that pain ruin me anymore, but how can I share my pain and how can I fill myself with helping others through that pain? So sobriety to me, when I read that passage, is it's not about saying no to things that are bad. It's saying yes to the good that God has for us. And it's life-giving. Sobriety isn't easy. Walking through your pains and your hurts, it's not easy. I'll never forget this moment. It's when you can tell that you've realized that you no longer believe the false story. It doesn't mean you lie about the pain and the hurt. Because I want everyone to hear me that. I never want anyone to say, Pastor Matt, you said to ignore or to deny the pain and the legitimate hurt. That's not what I'm saying. We all have it. We've all experienced it. But there comes a moment when all of a sudden you begin to realize your circumstances aren't your value, the cross. You can look at the cross and see that God loves you. Your value is not in what happened to you, but in what they did to Jesus and how God allowed His Son to pay the ultimate price. And it begins to tell a story that you were created in His image and that you were loved and that you matter deeply to Him. And it was never His will for you, for whatever that was that hurt you. That was not His will. Just like movies, where the hero is always down and out and has a choice to believe the story of evil and betrayal, or to believe the story where they are loved and they are important and they matter and they can make a difference. I'll never forget the day it happened for me. I was dating, I married her, she's my wife Stephanie now. And if you see her, you'll be like, I don't understand that. I don't understand how that works. I see you. That doesn't make sense, but God is gracious. She's the homecoming queen of the high school that I went to. She's beautiful and smart, wonderful. And I wasn't most of those things my life. And we were dating. And we're practicing purity as much as we possibly could for being young single people. And she had asked me, "Hey, a bunch of my friends are going to the beach. Can I go? Would you be mad if I went?" And I said, "I don't think no." She goes, "Oh, by the way, my ex-boyfriend of 4 years is going to go." Now, the old Matt, controlling Matt, angry victim Matt, had several ways to deal with that. First, there was violence. I could do that. But I'd been out for a while, and I liked being free. If you've been locked up, it's, other than the three hots and cots, it's not fun. Other than that, it isn't. You know, I, the other things I can deal without. So I figured that wouldn't be a really good response. I figured maybe I could use anger and manipulation to not lose the one relationship that I really valued. Because, I mean, the lie always whispers to me, "You won't be loved. You'll be let down. No one will ever really love you. Once they get to know you, they'll leave you. Don't worry. It'll happen. So you better do whatever you can to control and protect." I remember it. I can remember it like I'm still there. I was driving my car down the road. And it was one of those, it was in Loudoun County, and it's one of those country roads that you see like in advertisements. I mean, it was gravel, but the sky was crystal blue, and there were a few white fleeting clouds, and the trees were beautifully green on either side, and the sun was out, and the window was down, and as I was driving to her house to go, what do I do? The story kicked in. God loves me. He made me. If He can love me, I must be okay. And if I'm not everything, that's okay too. If I'm good enough for God to love, then that should be good enough for others. And I'll never forget that moment of sobriety, because when I walked through the door, instead of controlling, instead of anger, instead of bitterness, instead of wanting to go drink or smoke or do all the things that I used to do when I felt abandoned and hurt and betrayed, all that, whenever someone would strike that and bring that up, that would be my default position. Go numb the pain. But the story began to sit after going to church and after hearing it, after being involved in groups like this and being with people who would tell you that there's a God who made you and a God who loves you and there's a God who's for you. I remember walking in that room, and I remember as calmly as I'm sitting here, I went, "You know what? I can't tell you what to do. Here's what I can tell you. If you want to go, great. I think it would be really unfair of our relationship if you went with your boyfriend for 4 years and spent a week at the beach. And I don't think that would be fair to us. So you can go, but when you come back, I won't be your boyfriend, because I just need to really set some, I didn't know the term, but I do now, boundaries. You know, if you want to do that, that's great. And I'm just not going to manipulate you. You do what you want." And I left. And she chose not to go. And I wish I could tell you that my journey has not been without pain or struggle or even failure. Because that would be a lie. But I would tell you, I would encourage you, don't let the legitimate hurt and the pain create a false story that robs you from the true story that you are meant to be a son or daughter. My encouragement would be, don't aim at not doing. Aim at being something. Aim at living. Don't not do to not do. Fill yourself with something else. The church that we used to meet in was like this. And I can remember sitting, I usually would sit on this side over there, kind of towards the back. And I would hear our pastor, he's a good guy, and he would preach, and people's lives would be changed. And I would beg God Hey, God, could you ever use a mess up like me to make a difference in the world? I've been following Jesus for almost 47, so about 30 years now. And he's never disappointed. So, hear the truth. You are loved. You are mattered. And you have a destiny. Thanks for letting me share my story.